So I guess I should formally announce that this is the J-Crete session on QRS and microservices on Thursday, right, at 9:45. Is anyone going to take notes?
You can take a recording then.
I guess that's good enough.
I'm making a mind map for things that are important to me, so it's not going to be a protocol of...
I'm sure that's fine. So, I mean, the reason I sort of got into this was kind of twofold. So, number one, I was kind of going down the route of using a microservice architecture, where, you know, you break up the app into services, and each service has its own database. And as soon as you have multiple databases, then you run into issues of, well, firstly, you're likely to have sort of data that needs to be replicated and synchronized between various databases. And then the notion that, well, if you've got sort of a business transaction, like, let's say, you know, a standard example of transferring money between two bank accounts, well, in theory, those bank accounts could be in different databases. And so now we've got something that looks like a distributed transaction, except that, you know, these days people don't use two-phase commits. So then you've sort of got you need a mechanism to implement an eventual consistency mechanism.
They don't use two-phase commits?
Oh, that's seriously like out of fashion.
Really?
Well, yeah, I mean, like, you know, the whole CAP theorem, right? Where you have basically you're choosing between consistency and availability. And these days, well, at internet scale, shall we say.
We'll start at non-critical applications, perhaps, but in every application I work in, living, it's two-phase, everything, banking or financial applications, but it's certainly not to substitute or give up any consistency for availability and performance, definitely not.
That's interesting, because if you'd look at other just internet companies, shall we say, you know, eBay was a great example. They wrote an article back 6 years ago, I forget what it was, some time ago. It's really worth reading, and like their architecture, if I remember correctly, they had multiple Oracle databases, but they never used two-phase commit. They had a
EW2, no? I assumed that it was automatically a two-phase under the hood. EW1 to begin with, and then EW2.
Well, I mean, so, no, I mean, basically, from their perspective, the trouble with two-phase commit, right, is that all of the participants have to be available in order for the transaction to commit.
Yeah.
Right? Plus, also, I actually haven't used a app server that supports two-phase commit since about 2004, right? Like, you know, I remember way back you'd use WebSphere and WebLogic and those, but in the environments I've worked in, we ditched all that and just switched to Jetty and Tomcat.
That's the preferred stack, I'm sure, but for bigger companies, they're still using WebSphere, certainly in Belgium, everything is
Well, I mean, there's a split, right? These two kind of camps in this world, right? There's the banking kind of conservative organization.
The blah, blah, blah. And then the cool crowd.
Yeah, then there's the cool crowd, right? Who are, you know, like, and you could say that ultra cool crowds are the Amazons, the Googles, the Facebooks, the Netflix, and then all the little startups that want to be like them, right? And for them, two-phase commit, you just don't use it. And it doesn't mean that you give up on, right, so you switch from an ACID model, right, which is, at least in theory, you see consistent data, though, I mean, obviously there's subtleties around, like, isolation levels and stuff like that, right, to an eventually consistent model. So, like, the way the eBay guys worked was, say if you updated a table in database A, you would actually, in that same transaction, insert an event into a table that basically acted like a message queue. to say, go update some other table in database B. So that was sort of one local transaction, and then you had another process that pulled that message queue and applied that event and hence updated the table in database B. So the tables would eventually become consistent.
Yeah, that's fair enough. That sounds like an Oracle advanced queue. That's probably where they got that from.
Well, it sort of moved it up to the application level. Yeah, in a way. And yeah, I mean, if you spend $1 million, you get Oracle, right? But the cool kids do not use Oracle, right?
Uh-oh. Only Oracle does, isn't it?
Yeah. But I also know how much it costs, so I understand that the cool guys don't use Oracle.
Yeah. Okay, so gosh, I didn't think that would take that. It's funny, I've had this discussion, and no one said, hang on, we use two-phase commits. But, I mean, it's just interesting. I mean, that's one of the cool things about this conference, is you get different perspectives on things. But anyway, so you can imagine a scenario where you're a cool company and you don't use two-phase commit because of the CAP theorem, which says and you prefer availability over consistency, so you end up with an eventual consistency model. And so you need a mechanism for keeping databases in sync or implementing eventually consistent workflows. And then the other way I got into this is if you're like super cool, then you don't even use a relational database, right? And you use a NoSQL database like Cassandra or Mongo. And then you end up with a similar problem. Because those databases don't support ACID transactions. Like, you can only update a single, should we say, row in Mongo or Cassandra. In Mongo, you can only update a single document, or in Cassandra, you can only update a single row, and atomically. And so if you need a business transaction that updates multiple storage units, you have to implement a mechanism by hand, which is very similar to the habit of updating multiple databases in a microservices architecture. And so basically a good way to do that is with an event-driven architecture. So microservices, for example, when they change a state in one of their databases, the microservice publishes an event saying, hey, I've changed the state, I've debited this account, and then another microservice can subscribe to that event and update its database and publish an event which then might trigger. So it kind of, you end up with this model where whenever anything changes, you publish an event and someone subscribes that then drives some other update. And then the final part of this is, well, how do you publish events? Like, how, you know, so the one way is simply in your business logic, whenever you change an entity, to say, I've changed this entity event. But then there's actually a really interesting thing where to reliably publish events actually kind of requires something that starts looking like two-phase commit, because exactly. You got to update. And
so the event does too. Yeah.
Okay, so that's where you're, so that's kind of a long chain of things, right? And so then the solution I've kind of solved all of these problems is to use event sourcing. And the big idea behind that is, instead of storing the current state of an entity in the database, right? What you do is actually explicitly model the events, the state changing events, like account opened, account debited, account credited, and you actually persist the events and instead of the current state, and you reconstitute the current state by loading the events and replaying them. And it so happens that, well, if you publish events, then you've kind of got this thing that looks like a database and looks like a message broker, and you can atomically kind of persist and publish in one go. So it's a very, you know, we've had discussions about ORMs and other database access mechanisms. So this sort of totally changes how you do things. You simply, there's no, the schema effectively consists of one table event. And the primary key for that table is basically, well, you know, you can query it to find the events for a given entity of a particular type, and you get back time-ordered series.
So whoever's interested in those events would then register for those events. Let's say the events are persisted in an Oracle advanced queuing type of scenario, which is in fact in a database, and then anyone interested in those events will then go and read them and then update their own data, as it were. So that would ultimately be a catch and dispatch type of area for multiple databases underneath to keep them all in sync.
Yes.
So it almost acts as if it's a publish subscribe kind of guaranteed topic rather than a queue. So everyone will subscribe to that topic, and then they can modify their data in their own time, as it were.
Yes, exactly. So you've got this event store that's simultaneously acting as a database of events and also a message and also a pub sub. Reliable pub-sub message broker as well.
Yeah, that's why I said I worked on a project that was kind of C-curious, or they thought that it was, but in fact it had nothing to do with event sourcing. They were only using half of that methodology, which is, I like to view it as a command pattern applied to databases, where you build an object and furnish it with everything it's required to then make some kind of query or update in the database, and then just let it do its thing in an async type of fashion. And in fact, it wasn't really C-curious. It was in fact just kind of the pattern side of that methodology. Is that right?
Yeah, sounds related.
Okay.
So then, so that's event sourcing. So big idea is persist the events, not current state. Replay events to construct the.
Okay, and when you persist the when you persist the event, and you said that the our service is monitoring for this event, so how is it done? So how is the our service will monitor event that is persisted to database? Is it like you are publishing to queue, or?
Well.
So talking about technologies, what are you using for that? So then you are making an insert in the database. How do other services understand that you have made this insert?
There's a couple of different ways to go. I mean, like there are some, there are some event stores out there that just proprietary black boxes. But let's imagine, I've done this on top of a SQL database. So let's imagine that, the one operation is save these new events for an entity, right? So that's going to insert the events into an event table. And then the consumers, like one naive implementation for a consumer is basically to periodically pull the event table and, find me the events of this type whose event ID is greater than the event the last processed event ID.
Doesn't this put a big pressure on the database?
Well, that as I said, that would be a naive implementation.
Okay. And what are you using?
I've sort of been working on my own event store implementation, which is actually sitting on top of Amazon's DynamoDB. Though I chose that because it's just a hosted data store that I didn't have to worry about administering. And the way it's effectively working is, in the worst case, you do actually have to go to the database and query for all events since. So there's sort of two scenarios. So when a consumer connects, it actually does go query the database to find all of the events since the last event ID that the consumer has processed, right? But then for a consumer that's actually connected, when events are saved in the database, they're also just handed over to the consumer as well.
So it's pushed.
It's sort of a simple, rudimentary message broker, in essence.
So and it is built on top of DynamoDB.
Yeah, but because basically what you can think that the consumers are like, they're basically like durable subscribers, like in I guess JMS, right, where you've got a persistent, long-lived message queue, and you. What a consumer could be up or down, and when it's and then when it reconnects, it just gets it's guaranteed to get all of the events.
What about adding a new microservices to the system? Then you need to do some kind of feature load. So do you keep all events in time, or do you full state every time?
So, right. So basically, if you added a new consumer, it would actually, and then subscribe to a given event type, it would actually process all events since the beginning of time.
Yes.
Well, there's sort of an assumption that disk is cheap.
Not only disk. We are also interested in the number of operations that we need to perform to get the final state out of the zillion of events.
Oh yeah, that's funny. Yeah, so in theory, right? Like if you had a bank account that was 5 years old, you'd have to replay all the debits and credits since the beginning of time, which could be quite expensive. So the standard solution is to actually periodically create a snapshot, basically insert into the event stream a snapshot event that's basically the current state of the object. So rather than having to find all events since the beginning of time, you go back to the latest snapshot and then reconstitute the entity from that, and then just replay the events that occurred afterwards.
And at which time we can perform this snapshot? Because I think that the moment in time is very important. So that all consumers, I don't know.
Well, the consumers just see events, and they don't necessarily care about snapshot events, right? But if you want to get the current state of an entity, then there's an optimization to.
Well, one company, their international Bayer, are adopting the seekers, and they won't accept absolutely nothing else. They're just completely stuck on this for the simple reason that they have 300 databases that are distributed to different clients, different places. But this is their whole. So that would be a use case for this type of architecture methodology.
Yeah, I mean, so it's kind of like, as I said, start, right? You've got microservices mean multiple databases. You have NoSQL, which are limited transactions. And so you need events, and a good way of reliably generating events is basically is event sourcing.
Yeah. But a nice way to distribute those events would be a grid, wouldn't it? So you just pop it in a grid. The grid will have some kind of a right behind the backing system to probably an Oracle database.
MySQL.
MySQL.
Please go MySQL.
MySQL, really? Okay.
There's a large part of the world that runs on MySQL.
Yeah.
Even though I actually think, say, Postgres is actually a better database, but MySQL.
Yeah, that's true enough. However, I've got a VM that's been running for about 5 years, and every time it goes down, the two databases that still stay up are DB2 and Oracle, and the rest of them, dead. They literally have to be reinstalled. So, we'll just say that the backing store is then some kind of relational database. Wouldn't that be a nice way to publish events? Let's say, for example, Hazelcast in a grid, so all the consumers would then
connect to the grid, as it were, and they could it would be obviously topic, but durable topics. I think Hazelcost or any of the grids like GridGain or GigaSpaces would provide durability with respect to that, and right behind. So anyone that's not connected to the grid at that time would then,
yeah.
Wouldn't that be a nice way to distribute the events?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the only constraint is you do need some like atomicity around persisting the events and publishing them. So I haven't kind of looked at GridGain in this context, but...
Yeah, you can lock down the cluster. That's the atomicity is almost guaranteed in the case of Hazelcost as well, but in the beginning days they weren't so good, but yeah, that's absolutely guaranteed.
Yeah.
So you can guarantee first lock the that store, as it were, that distributed map, because that's essentially what it is, and then insert your new event for the topic.
Okay. So then the other thing I should say is, so I've been talking about event sourcing, then the other part of this is, so what's this CQRS thing, right? And that's command query responsibility separation. And the idea there is that really there's two parts to your app. One is the command processing that's sort of doing updates. And then there's the view side, which is supplying data that gets displayed on screens. And there's sort of the observation is that the needs of those two updates and reads are actually very different. For instance, you know, like high performance reads, you might want to denormalize the data, right? Have a materialized view so that you can just retrieve data very quickly. And then the way that ties in with event sourcing is event sourcing, really all you can do with the event store is effectively ask for the current state of an entity by primary key. Whereas if you want to display some data on the screen, you probably have some joins across effectively multiple entities. So what you end up having to do is some of the subscribers, they're actually subscribing to a bunch of different events and maintaining a view, a denormalized view of the data that can then be queried very efficiently.
Okay, so the events are then utilized to keep a specific view in sync.
Yes, so it's kind of like in Oracle speak, right? You've got materialized views, right, that get updated. So one kind of subscriber is actually on the command side that's updating other entities, but then you've got other subscribers that are maintaining these views. And so the views could be, it's funny that it was JCrete last year, I was talking with Rickard Oberg, and he's described a scenario where, well, one view type is actually MongoDB, because that's, you're basically storing JSON documents, and that's great for just serving up reasonably complex documents to a web client, right? They just go in, grab the document, which has got a whole bunch of denormalized data, and they just get it and then render it on the screen. And then another view type could be Neo4j, graph database storing social data, you know, storing like social graphs and stuff. And then you can run graph operations over it. So you've got all these sort of specialized view types that are optimized for the view use case, rather than trying to do everything with just one single database. And so that seems to work quite well.
And you've used that in a production environment?
Production.
Yeah. Full scale.
Yeah, yeah, I've got one user. Actually, two users right now.
Three now.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah, no, I mean, so the app that I'm working on has this architecture. But, and it seems to work.
Also, the adding a new view type would be fairly easy.
Yeah, exactly. So a new view type is basically a new subscriber, which can then just replay all the events since the beginning of time, which could have interesting performance consequences in the future. I mean, but you know, one solution is perhaps to kind of write some other kind of I don't know, you could write some map reduce job or something that actually creates the view from all the historical data, and so it doesn't actually have to replay since the beginning of time. I mean, there's sort of other kind of other strategies for bootstrapping.
Well, I don't think it's really an issue if the consumers need to update their data using the entire data store of events. It's just the way it is. Just add more CPUs and hopefully the caching and whatever on the DBs or the backing stores are sufficient, because inevitably it's going to be I/O, not like one CPU.
Yeah.
Unless you're using SSD, which no one is, I guess. So that's just the way it is, you know. I mean, if you have new consumers that need to process all that data, you just add more machines on.
But you also have network considerations. If not local on the XL,
then it's network.
Yeah.
Trying to pump gigabytes across some network.
But I can imagine a scenario. I haven't implemented anything like this yet, but I can imagine all of the events from you know, the sort of the transaction processing system actually get dumped into like HDFS. So then I could run some kind of map reduce job to basically compute the view from all of the historical data, and then just then the view only has to process more recent events once it's sort of been initialized.
Well, I guess you could also fit in, GridGain has got a nice feature which is data cohesion. So in that case, depending on how the data is partitioned, let's say, for example, let's say events in this case, you can execute the logic on the machine where the data is, which obviously then avoids the transfer of the data across the network. Typically in production environments, all five anyway, so the network's really not going to be the I/O, it's really going to be off the disk. In my experiences.
But yeah, I mean, I think there's sort of a whole bunch of just different sort of technologies in this space that can help. Grid gain.
What is the objective of it anyway? I mean, is it to abstract and to simplify multiple underlying databases? Or ultimately an abstraction layer on top of them, multiple databases? Or is it with a view to scalability and lateral scalability, or both? Was that separate use cases?
Well, it's sort of, it's like microservices and NoSQL databases as solutions to a bunch of different yet related problems. And so obviously NoSQL, it's more about performance and scalability concerns, right?
Yeah.
And then microservices, they're solving the problems that arise when you have a gigantic complex monolithic application. And so it's sort of, you want to break it up into little services that are much more manageable
and reusable.
Yeah, potentially reuse is high on, but potentially reusable as well. And so it's kind of like, it's like you have these problems, you solve them with MySQL and, sorry, with NoSQL and microservices, and then those introduce this kind of multiple database synchronization problem. And then you solve that with events, and then so there's sort of this whole chain of problems that for which event sourcing is the solution.
For which we will stay in business, of course, and get good contractual fees for the rest of our natural lives.
Which is also that would be good. Is anyone listening? I'm available.
Maybe Eric was looking at.
So another benefit of event sourcing is that if you have a mistake in your program, and you find out it after 24 hours after deployment, then all your data is crashed if you don't use events. And if you are storing user actions as a raw events, then you can just fix a mistake and replay all the events. So
yeah. I mean, like, good example, right? So there's the view computation code. You got some buggy view computation code. You could just fix the bug and just recompute the view from
save point.
Yeah.
Particular point.
And then also the other advantage of this is you get automatic audit logging as well, because inherently you're saving, you're persisting everything the user does.
And there's one mass open source library, I don't remember the name, they have a very nice site, very fancy. Do you know which one that is?
Which one?
I can't remember the name of it.
So what does it do?
CQRS, specifically CQRS Library. It's the only one at the time, it was about 6 months ago that I had a squiz.
Well, there's sort of a couple of different ones. So Akka framework has Akka persistence, which implements persistent actors by saving events. So that's basically event sourcing. And then Greg Young had a .NET event store, like geteventstore.com or something like that. So those are the only two I know of.
Yeah, there was one. I went for an interview, in fact, at this company, Bayer, chemical company.
Oh, yeah.
Ever heard of it?
Yeah.
And that was their total focus at that time. Obviously, they had a total nightmare with their database for the last 17 years. And that was the only one that was available. There was this library.
Oh, yeah, curious. I mean, I'm curious to know.
But it looked quite fancy. And they had a really fancy website. It was the only one I could find.
So, it's not geteventstore.com.
No, it wasn't. Google knows all the... No, it's not really important. You can look it up at some later point.
What's the test framework you mentioned, Chris? Was that Anchor or Akka?
Akka. So that's this Gala Actor framework. So that was the event store. Website.
Are you connected to it?
Yeah, well, I was.
Sometimes.
Using what? The wireless?
Oak 14. It just, it's like random numbers.
Yeah, the one that works changes every half hour.
Yeah, there was an open source project called Event Sourced that provided that implemented persistent actors, and then that got sort of folded into Akka. And it looks interesting. I thought it was too Akka centric for my taste.
But you're quite a big Scala fan.
I am a big Scala fan, yeah.
Well.
All the cool kids just use Scala. Scala, no SQL.
Yeah, no, we're gonna print you top then.
MySQL, if they have to use SQL.
Yeah.
Facebook's still using MySQL, then.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like if you look at how people are using solving database scalability problems, it's like, well, one way is you give Larry Ellison tons and tons of money, right? You buy high-end servers and you spent by, multi-million dollar Oracle, or you do what Facebook does and take MySQL and hire a whole bunch of people and build up a distributed sort of database infrastructure.
I don't think they intended that to. I think it just got out of hand. By the time they realized they needed more space, it was just too late to migrate.
Yeah, or then you look at, say, what Netflix have done, where they use Cassandra, which is, so they've got a globally distributed database infrastructure that's basic, out of the box, Cassandra is like, you get clusters and WAN replication and all kinds of good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
But no transactions?
No, but...
Not only no transactions, but also no rich queries. You also can just...
Yeah. So
the
so
queries capability is very limited.
Yeah, so actually what you end up it's what you end up having to do is actually have denormalized representations of your data that are queryable using the Cassandra's abilities.
So you make a data store for each query.
What's that?
Yes, you make a data store for each query, basically.
Yeah. So yeah, materialized view per query, and it's remarkable. I mean, you can, it ends up working. But once again, it's a data synchronization replication problem.
In the big companies, they just take Oracle, strap it against 16 disks, and that's it. You've got your 5 tera of storage capacity, and if they need more, they just add more machines. More racks.
Yeah. Well, it's a safe choice, right? Like, it's familiar. I mean, there are advantages, right? I mean, it's SQL, it's ACID. You don't get fired for buying Oracle, right? It's a safe choice.
But even if you start saying denormalized, I think, oh, shit. Which is the real copy of your data? Which is the truth?
Yeah, well, I mean, you sort of have, you've got kind of one table that's effectively the official truth, and then you've got, for each complex query, you've got a materialized view.
Yeah.
And
those materialized views have to get updated, and that's quite a lengthy process. Which point of the database has to be frozen then?
Well, no, actually, perhaps materialized view is the wrong term. I mean, well, it's kind of like whenever you update the master table, you then have to make sure that you update the replicas. You don't reconstruct them from scratch. It's like incremental updates.
Materialized views do that too much.
Yeah. So nothing's frozen. It's just, I mean, the one downside of this is that it's eventual consistency.
But even good old monolithic applications could benefit from event sourcing and stuff. My current customer, they have a 10-year-old virtual application using GLB2.1 that's actually consuming data from another application, and that's kind of growed over time. So now this hourly replication is turning into an hour and 10 minutes. So if that source system could publish its data on event sourcing, it will be easy to keep the monolithic applications' data more in sync, faster and easier, and lower load on the databases. So yes, as it is good in a lot of situations, but communicating between two different vendors' applications, well, this is a way to go.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that's true. Like, it's like if every application published events, then I think that solves a whole bunch of challenges that you get within the enterprise. You could have some legacy app, and then you could start rewriting it. You know, it's sort of one standard strategy. It's like, instead of modifying, implementing new functionality in the legacy app, you create a new app using modern technology that's implementing the new functionality, but then you kind of have to connect the two somehow. And if the legacy app published events, then, and actually had an API for updating as well.
It's modernized the legacy app first, but it does this stuff.
But if you think about it, right, like going forward, if the apps that we built had APIs and published events, then 20 years from now, when people are trying to deal with legacy issues, they would be in a much happier place.
Well, you talk about isn't that always the problem? In 20 years, we're going to be on another different technological base. 20 years ago, everyone was saying, look, put everything in an enterprise DB. You have all your data there, a single point of truth, and everything can connect to this thing. Mm-hmm. And now we're saying, oh, don't do that.
Yeah.
Public events.
I suppose I'd argue that if apps have APIs and publish events, they're inherently more open.
APIs, when you say APIs, what do you mean by that exactly? An interface or something like that?
Yeah.
REST services.
Say REST.
REST, okay.
Right, and yeah, we might be using some weirdo protocol 20 years from now, but at least REST gives you access, right? Versus, say, having to do screen scraping or whatever, you know.
Yeah, but direct connection to the database gives you access to.
Yeah.
Apps typically don't want to share the database, especially when there's kind of big organizations where there's 100 or
databases.
Well, they won't share the database.
Sorry.
Yeah. But read all their databases at the laptop. In many cases.
Right, because the problem for the big boys is that you can't have that one single source of the truth. I don't see Google, Facebook, or Amazon running on one Oracle, or on a whatever racked Oracle that can throw that rack actually in our place.
And also,
I mean, you're at a certain point, and then you need to go to multiple.
Yeah.
And you're end up in a situation that for this type of thing, we need heavy rights to take that technical solution. And this one, it's all reading and reporting, let's take that solution.
How do you cope with security with respect to that? That's another thing. Say, for example, the event is an update of a bank account. So obviously inside the event there's all kinds of information with respect to the update of that particular account or that data. But there's a restriction to who can in fact access that, because you don't want kind of the web apps in accessing the transaction, the financial transaction data. Is there some kind of mechanism that could be applied to that? How would you do that?
Yeah, you. I mean, because I guess from your perspective, you would leverage Oracle security, right?
Yes.
Whereas, you know, the issue, we got 5 minutes. You know, the issue with these, you know, newfangled NoSQL databases is they don't. I don't think they really do much in the security area. It's pushed up to the application.
Yeah. So that would be an issue for who do you want to subscribe to your events?
What?
Then need some sort of certificates for a subscriber.
Indeed. I mean, you could still provide that grid gain. I've just recently been switched, actually, as it turns out, to Grid Gain, have got security mechanisms for that, so you could apply authorization to who can take those messages out of the grid. So that's all possible. I was just curious to know if anyone had thought of that, and that's one of the things that pops into my head instantly is security.
Yeah, I don't know if anyone really has, other than that, you just deal with it at sort of the application level.
Yeah. In a demilitarized fashion. So you're trusting everyone that accesses that data. Yeah. In the companies I work at that wouldn't fly, they would have to be security, which is of course doable completely. But everyone's going in the grid direction, don't you find? That's just the first thing that pops up.
Well, yeah, kind of, sort of in-memory computing.
That's right. In-memory, everything for distribution, distributed computation, data for messaging, all kinds of things. It's just, you know, almost a silver bullet for putting everything everywhere. So I don't know, that's most of the apps that I've worked on in the last 2 years, in fact, are grid-oriented or have some kind of grid. So that's why.
But for instance, you're going back to the classic, like I have a bank account and I've got a bunch of transactions on that bank account. They have to be stored in Oracle in your case, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, were you saying like between the app and Oracle, there's a grid of some kind?
Oh no. There would be a grid between nodes of the same app, typically. So in a cluster. Let's say your app is runs in production on 6 or 12 machines. Those machines would then be connected using a grid.
Yeah,
no, there's nothing in between the app and the database or backing store. Typically, the grid will be via the backing store anyway.
And how do you ensure timicity of updates to database and writes to grid?
Writes to grid, the grid will handle itself, and atomicity to the database is handled by the database.
So yes, but they are not connected, so you may update the database, but the write to grid would fail.
Typically, you would write to the grid, and the grid would write to the database.
Ah, okay, so grid is writing to the database.
Yes, as a write behind, so it will literally queue. In fact, that's almost a similar mechanism. It will literally queue up writes, or in some cases, it depends how you configure it, depends how you do it. In a lot of cases, you just want to use the grid as some kind of distributed cache, but in one case that I've been involved in, it was used as a write behind to the database as well, which is convenient. And then the database itself would guarantee atomicity at a JPA level.
And okay, and you say that other nodes are subscribers for events that are published to the grid.
They could be, indeed, they could be subscribers, that's right. That you just subscribe like a JMS topic. And,
but is,
I think it might be quite a nice fit, this whole event sourcing and grid computing.
So you say that grid gain, for example, could be used for event sourcing?
I think so. In fact, yeah, why not? If all your little consumers just, as they come up, they commit to the grid, they register themselves as consumers for events, and the grid will then publish those events
but
to the grid. Wow, that's just so easy.
But grid just keeps all the data in the memory?
Not necessarily, no, not by any length of the imagination. There's always some kind of eviction policy, and typically that will be written to a persistent.
But okay, but if you have the eviction, how you would replay all the events?
Oh, you would just pull them back out of the database. So the grid itself would keep itself in sync, as it were.
Ah, okay, so then you query from the grid, it will go to the database if the element
was. Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, so it'll keep, let's say, for example, the last million events in memory, and then all the rest in the data store. In the event you query for event number zero, the grid will typically say, have I got that somewhere in memory? No, sure, off it goes to the database and it queries it, puts it in the grid and makes it available to all consumers. I think that's quite a nice fit, in fact.
Hmm. That sounds good.
Yes.
Good anyway, I guess.
Yeah.